Follow me down this deep, dark hole.
Hello, and welcome to New Horror Express. I'm your host, Scott Murphy, and thank you for joining us for our latest edition of our Guilty Pleasure series, a series we have been doing in conjunction with Bloodhound Picks' hashtag Horror Not Fear campaign, a campaign which hopes to deepen ties within the indie podcast and reviewing community, as well as giving you, the listener at home, some extra fun content in this weirdest and most depressing of years. This month's edition of the series takes a look at Backwoods Horrors. Specifically, we asked you on social media whether you wanted us to talk about Wrong Turn 2, Dead End, or Trailer Park of Terror. And in pretty much a landslide victory, you went with 2007's Wrong Turn 2, Dead End, directed by Joel Lynch, who is probably best known for Mayhem. The movie currently holds a 5.5 on IMDb, and a 78% on Rotten Tomatoes, more of which in a minute. Now, of course, you don't just want to listen to me talk about this movie, and that is why, as always, I am joined by a most excellent co-host in the form of the Parish director, Paddy Murphy. Hi, Paddy. Welcome to the show.
Hey, Scott. How are you doing? I'm delighted to be back.
Now, before we get into the movie, I want to talk a little bit about that RT rating, because I must admit, I feel I may have got this one wrong. The episodes that we've done previously, they are all very much guilty pleasure movies. Jason X, Leprechaun in the Hood, Dreamcatcher, Cherry Falls, you know, it had a good movie trying to burst out, but like it's kind of mixed bag. And Dracula 2000, they're all very much guilty pleasure movies. This movie, I don't know, like I think I remember seeing it a while back, and I think it just kind of was in my head as part of the Wrong Turn franchise, and I just think it's kind of, I just have it in my mind as a kind of ropey franchise, a kind of guilty pleasure franchise, but it seems that this is very much the best entry. I've not seen all the entries. There are six of them. And I'm not sure it entirely meets my definition of a guilty pleasure movie, which, as you may remember if you listened to previous episodes of this series, my definition that I gave in the very first episode was a movie that I found enjoyable, but if I was to review it for the site, I could not give it a good rating. And by a good rating, I mean 3 stars or above. So we're talking about movies of a kind of 2.5 star or below. And this one is, I think I could give it a good rating. I think, and I could probably give it 3 stars, but and I certainly know somebody who might give it even more than that. So biggest Wrong Turn 2 fan, Paddy Murphy.
I'd like to think so. I doubt it. I bet there are people out there that have like all the merch and memorabilia and all that stuff. But I guess if you're talking like about how you feel about something from the heart, I would put myself up there as one of the biggest Wrong Turn 2 fans. I like to think that this episode is not a guilty pleasure. It's just pleasure.
It's just all pleasure for
non-guilty pleasure. we don't learn about that in these Catholic countries we grew up in.
Oh dear. So yeah, this is the all pleasure edition of the Guilty Pleasure series.
Scott, when you put it out that there's, I was like, yeah, I'll do that episode 100%. And I was just like, please, God, let it be Wrong Turn 2 and not Trailer Park of Terror. Please, God. And,
have you ever seen Trailer Park of Terror?
I haven't. And that's probably a guilty pleasure. It's probably really fun.
It is quite fun, yeah.
But as I say, for me, it was like one of my favorite movies or Trailer Park of Terror. And I was like, please be Wrong Turn 2, please.
Well, I mean, it won by quite some way. You know, it was the Twitter poll was very much in its favor. I can't remember now, but I think it was like 80% or something like that. You know, it was it got definitely the most votes. So the last couple of these episodes that I've done with Abe and Adam, you know, we kind of run through the kind of plot of Leprechaun in the Hood and Jason X, and we'll kind of do something similar here. We don't have to be as precise as I was in those two episodes, but we'll do our best to do it in a kind of vaguely chronological order for the listener at home.
That suits my notes. That's fine.
Okay. Okay. So I've got some notes too. We'll just kind of run through it. So Wrong Turn 2, Dead End. It has none of the original cast or crew or director. It's totally different, and it is basically the setup is it's a kind of reality TV show. There's a kind of survivor style TV show.
Ultimate survivalist
apocalypse. To give it its full title. The movie opens with some lovely establishing swamp shots just to know that we're in a kind of backwards horror.
Oh, just one quick note, actually. There is no returning cast members, but there is one returning monster, Three Fingers,
yes.
Is from the first movie.
That is correct. Played by a different actor.
Yeah.
The Three Fingers in the original was played by, I believe, Julian Richings. And in this movie, he's played by Jeff Scruton, I think his name is. So yes, there is one of the mutants is the same.
The only connective tissue.
Other than that, no connective tissue whatsoever. So mind you, not that you know, like there's other horror sequels that are like that as well. Mm. I recently rewatched last week Slumber Party Massacre 2. And Hello Mary Lou Prom Night 2, both of which have nothing to do with the fucking originals.
Yeah, sometimes, I mean, with certain movies, it's sometimes for the best, you know, kind of wipe the slate clean and kind of come at it from a different angle. And I think, I mean, I don't know a lot about the behind the scenes of this movie, but you think I would, having listened to like 4 bazillion episodes of the Movie Crypt. But at the same time, I think that even though Wrong Turn 1 was a financial success, it didn't set the world on fire. And I think coming at it with a kind of like, okay, well, what could we possibly do differently? You know, and I mean, without getting ahead of ourselves here, it very much is kind of heavily in a lot of places, Joe Lynch's homage to Texas Chainsaw 2.
For sure. I mean it references a lot of different films from like Evil Dead to Blair Witch to, you know, various things indeed, and you know, just kind of riffing on the whole kind of horror sequels, you know, being kind of bigger and bloodier and gorier and, you know, like that kind of thing. Also, yeah, weirdly, it, like you say, it's weird that this movie that didn't set the world on fire, it kind of became a franchise. And I think there's probably quite a few horror fans that probably are not aware that it is a franchise, because like when you mention Wrong Turn to people, like quite often they're just like, oh, was that kind of backwards?
Is that the one with Faith from Buffy?
Yeah. Is that one with Liza Dishku? Yeah. I kind of vaguely remember. Also, it's kind of weird as well. Wrong Turn, the first one, came out in 2003, which was apparently the year of the hillbilly, because also the Texas Chainsaw Massacre remake and House of 1,000 Corpses came out in the same year. Wow. So, like, it's like,
it was a good year for hillbilly horror, definitely.
Yeah, 2003, year of the redneck. I don't know why, but you know.
But there was one thing all the movies you just listed were lacking. And again, getting a little bit ahead of myself here, but what all of those movies lacked was Henry Rollins as Rambo.
All of those movies could have been improved with Henry Rollins as Rambo. Yes, we'll get on to more of that soon. But we'll go back to the beginning, because the beginning is possibly it's certainly one of the highlights of the movie.
Definitely.
And probably I've not seen all six Wrong Turns, but probably the highlight of the franchise. So I'm just going to guess. But basically we open with Kimberly Caldwell, who I was not aware until I watched like the behind the scenes, was she was playing herself.
Yes.
She is an American Idol contestant.
Yeah.
She's playing a version of herself, obviously. And she's driving along the road in her Mustang, talking to Patton Oswalt, who is playing her agent. And there's a lovely line about Patton Oswalt telling her not to take the wrong turn, which
he
nice
also tells
touch.
Her he's doing power yoga, which I'm like, yes, I am all into seeing Patton Oswalt do power yoga.
So she very much does take the wrong turn. She then runs over one of the mutant hillbillies, who's simply called Brother, and
decides to stick her fingers into his mouth to try and help him, which is questionable. I don't know if in first aid classes that's the thing they tell you to do first. If you hit someone with your car, stick your fingers down their throat. I'm not sure. I mean,
yeah,
it's
yeah,
got some. It's pretty gory and delicious.
I don't know. Yeah, I don't. Yeah, I can't imagine that being in any kind of medical textbooks. That it's like, just take the fingers the back of the throat. No, they'll cough up blood and they'll be okay.
If you're getting that blood out of them, you know you're doing it right.
Yeah, absolutely. at that point, I found a rather confusing shot, Brother appears to bite into her neck, but then she comes away and he'd actually bitten into her face and ripped her lips off.
Yes, that is, I will absolutely admit to having the exact same thoughts there. I don't know whether there's blocking issues or whether it was an edit thing or I don't know. But I had the exact same thought. I was like, wait, he was biting her neck. Why is half her face gone? But I do love the special effects makeup on her face.
It's well done. It's really, and I watched a brief behind the scenes to see how they did it and that. No, it's very good.
But it's only the tip of the iceberg for what's to come when Pa shows up.
Exactly. Is it Pa? Or I thought
it was Pa. You only see
Isn't it Three Finger who pops up?
Possibly. I thought the big act. I'm not 100. I don't have it written in my notes who it was. In my head I thought it was Pa because I thought he had the checkered shirt and I thought Pa's weapon.
Yeah. Right. Yeah. I mean, it could very well be.
I think it's because Three Fingers, just to jump a little bit ahead here, Three mm-hmm. Fingers has her body later, so I think that's why it's like, oh, was that Three Fingers at the start? But someone out there on Twitter, correct me, like some bigger Wrong Turn 2 fan than me, Joe Lynch,
if you're listening to this, Joe Lynch, could you write in and just tell us, is it Three Finger, is it Pa? Who commits the first kill? We should get through the first kill. So the first kill happens just under 7 minutes in. So you know this film isn't fucking about. It's about 6.5 minutes in, and Kimberly is cut in half by an axe and
clean down the middle.
Just completely, I mean, obviously, completely impossible. But, you know, a fabulous...
Man, these hillbillies are strong.
Yes, no, I mean, I suppose, you know, chemically enhanced mutant hillbillies, you know, you have to take that into account.
Consideration. I think it breaks my heart that this isn't a more talked about kill. Like, I think when we talk about, like, iconic kills in horror movies, I think that this, definitely of the 2000s, I think that this is just, like, sheer perfection, especially in, like, how it's shot, because nowadays they just CGI it and it would look garbage, you know? But that whole idea of just showing you the legs and then having them flop to the sides and the guts, it's so, like, it doesn't show you everything. It doesn't need to. It's so good.
It is top class. I mean, like you say, I think certainly of the 2000s, I think it's certainly up there, or it should be talked about as a kind of iconic kill, because it is really spectacular stuff.
It hits all my sweet spots. It's just from the way it's shot to the amount of gore to like, it's just, and how fun it is. Like, it's such a ridiculous kill that, and like, as you say, 7 minutes into the movie, you get your tone established right away.
Yeah, I absolutely, you do, because like after that, whether it's Pa or Three Finger, we're not sure, but one of them plus brother, each of them takes a half and drags it away, and then we get a kind of comical kind of hillbilly score done by Bear McCreary, which kind of, you know, like, you know, we're in for a kind of fun ride of a movie, just between you, just the shot of these two hillbillies dragging half of a corpse each away to this kind of comical hillbilly music.
Amazing. And also, I just did a quick search there to end this once and for all, and you were spot on. It is Three Fingers in the opening, that with the axe.
Okay, cool.
All right. At least we have that cleared up now. I'm sorry, Joe. I apologize. We have that out of the way, though.
We have definitely established that Three Finger and brother take the corpse away, or half each.
Yes, and as you say, the score by Bear McCreary, just, it's so playful, and it's telling you right out the gate, like, that, you know what to expect. And you're not going to get necessarily high art, but if you're coming to Wrong Turn 2 looking for high art, you were in the wrong place. But you're going to get a lot of fun.
You're going to get fun times. So after that first kill, we cut to the kind of
the reality show,
and we get the kind of credits of the kind of titles of the reality show, which kind of swoosh across the screen, and it's all very kind of mid-2000s reality show. And then this is one of the things of, like, clearly the movie is kind of riffing on the kind of characters you would get in a reality show, so, like, obviously the characters have deliberately been written irritating, but that kind of doesn't make them any less irritating. So we get a kind of series of douchey intro videos to these various characters that at some point we're supposed to kind of care about. And then we get our first glimpse of the skateboarder dude bro Jonesy, who is the worst. He is the worst. I mean, slasher character standards, he's fucking terrible.
I think that Jonesy is there to be that, though. Like, I think Jonesy is not there to win your affections. He is not there to be likable. Jonesy is there to remind you that there are evils in this world worse than hillbilly cannibals, hillbilly cannibal mutants, and they are dude bros. Dude bros are immensely worse than anything you'll face in the backwoods. It's funny, because just to quickly touch on the other characters, I think that what this does really well here, though, is, and you kind of touched on it, is it does set them up that they're kind of all these cliched, douchey stereotypes that you'd expect to see on these shows. But I think what that allows the film to do later is kind of reveal more, like, it's kind of doing that playful thing of showing you, here are the stereotypes that you've come to expect in these type of things, whether it be a horror movie or a reality show. But then it's not going to play out specifically. You think, like, Jake, who you think is going to be the biggest asshole of the lot because he's the jock and, you know, whatever, he's actually kind of a sweetheart, like, you come to realize, who's trying to look after his family and, you know, like, or he's had this injury and he just wants to help other people. And, like, it does this, in my opinion, by setting it up, it shows you kind of that angular reality TV that's just awful, where they try to turn people into things that they're not, you know, or as in people act like they would never in reality to get on these reality shows. But I think all of them, that's kind of true for a lot of these characters, But Elena and Jonesy are just assholes. Like, there's no multiple layers to those characters. They're just dickheads. That's all.
They are just, yes. So Elena, you know, she's the kind of typical reality TV contestant who's like the kind of saucy vixen type. And that's, yeah, her character's not written anything beyond that. And yeah, Jonesy is just like dude bro sex pest, and his character's not written anything beyond that. Yeah, and we'll get to it later on, but there is something that kind of irritates me about the writing of that character as well, that happens. But that's much later on in the film.
Yeah.
So we'll,
and we
we'll
also
get to...
we're introduced here to, beyond the, those characters, we're also introduced to Mara, the producer of the show, and Matthew Curry Holmes, who is the director.
That is true. He is, yeah, the kind of Michael the director, or just M, as M. he likes to refer. He's a kind of, yeah, kind of sub Tarantino asshole.
What's amazing about that is that Matthew Curry Holmes often says that he came to set pretending to be Jolene. Which is why he's wearing a Battle Royale t-shirt. He said that literally he wore the Battle Royale t-shirt for the audition, and Jolene was like, "You're hired." And then, like, I don't think that I've met Joe several times. I don't think Joe would ever behave the way that M does, or is. I don't think he's anything like M, because M is very much a poser. Like, on the surface, you know, dude, again, he's not. I don't believe for a second that M is out there to make anything incredibly worthwhile. He just wants to make something that's sellable to the investors or whatever.
Yeah, like, I think so. Like, but I could imagine him having kind of slight pretensions. I could imagine.
I believe he thinks, yeah, that in certain ways, that, like, oh, the mise-en-scene of this shot and stuff. But, like,
yeah.
I think that, yeah, he says all that to sound legit. And I think inside he kind of believes a little bit of it. But I think his main motivations are just to make this sleazy, trashy piece of reality TV and get paid.
Yeah, for sure. But no, I think, like, there's a kind of slight air of pretension to him that I could imagine him being that kind of particular sub Tarantino type, you know, like the guy who directed, you know, that the guy who directed Boondock Saints, you know, like,
yeah,
fucking name.
But even the guys call him that, don't they, as they're walking away? The
the kind of tech,
like, yeah,
guys,
whatever, Tarantino, like, you know,
yeah, the they're like, yeah, whatever, man, we're gonna go to the hotel, you do your own fucking in the woods,
the woods thing. And I suppose we've kind of touched on all those characters, but we also, this part is where we meet the true hero of this film, the true star of this film, the champion of this film, Dale Murphy, played by Henry Rollins.
Well, I mean, yeah, Dale Murphy, played by Henry Rollins. He is fucking amazing. And
he's
like,
so good.
I feel like this movie could have even done with more of him. And
yes.
And I think this is what elevates the film, really. You know, like, I don't know. I mean, it probably be like, I think it probably would just be like a kind of guilty pleasure slasher without him. But, like, I feel like it elevates the movie. And, like, right from the get-go, right from the first time you see him, he's just awesome. And, you know, he puts Jonesy in his place, shouts at him to not promote stereotypes, you know, like...
him screaming at Jonesy is what I live for. Like, that's
it's
that
amazing.
Moment just so happy. But, like, the thing that I have to give Joe Lynch massive credit for here is that this is pre He Never Died. This is pre people seeing Henry Rollins as anything other than the lead singer of Black Flag, you know. He hadn't really been... I think he had appeared in maybe... who's the guy the New York director who does stuff with Bill Murray and Iggy Pop and stuff. He did, like, Coffee and Cigarette. Why is his name?
Oh, Jim Jarmusch.
Jim Jarmusch. I think Henry Rollins had maybe appeared in a Jarmusch thing, possibly.
Okay.
But, like, nobody
had
really
saw. Had he not been the one of the villains in Sons of Anarchy yet? Like, he, because I remember...
I don't think so. 2007. I don't think so.
I can't remember when.
Because, like...
It's Sons of Anarchy, I think, after.
I believe it was. I think Sons of Anarchy was until, like, I think I started watching that like 2009 or something.
I think you're right. Because I think Sons of Anarchy maybe started in like 08 or something. And it's the second season. He's one of the white supremacists in the second season.
But like, what, from kind of listening to Joe talk about stuff, from listening to Joe talk about the making of this film and stuff, he just cast Henry Rollins mainly because Joe's a huge music fan. Like, he's done some music videos for Faith No More, and he loved Henry Rollins, he loved Black Flag, and he obviously had an assuredness that like this role was perfect for Rollins. And I think it gave us, like, we wouldn't have gotten Henry Rollins in those other projects had he not done Wrong Turn 2, because he shines, he's electric, he is the star of the movie, in my opinion. And like you say, I would have gladly watched the whole 90 minutes of his character as the lead the whole way through, because I just loved him.
Yeah, absolutely. I absolutely agree with that. And he is brilliant in the film, throughout the film. And like, yeah, right from that establishing scene, and you know, he's just really cool. Him shouting at Jones, he's really cool, and then his little pep talk to Mara's like a nice kind of character moment. And yeah, it's just, we'll talk more Rollins soon. Yes. And, you know, because he is awesome throughout.
I'm sorry to be kind of cutting ahead of you here. Just,
no, sorry.
I presume you're going to speak next about how, like, we kind of, you know, with Mara, the producer, or at least this is what I have in my notes anyway, we kind of are set up to think that this is our final girl when we meet her, because she seems like all the things that we've come to expect in a horror movie from a final girl. She's a bit meek. She's a bit quiet compared to all these other girls that are in there, you know. And I kind of, just to go to, like, the first time I saw this movie, I was like, yeah, she's our final girl. She's the person we're going to be following throughout the whole, even especially because stuff like the Henry Rollins pep talk, I'm like, okay, she's our main character.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, for sure. What happens with her is obviously kind of interesting. We do get, you know, before we get into that, we do get another kill. The Michael's assistant, Neil, is killed on CCTV. His throat is slit, and then he is scalped while the others venture off into the woods. And they're all split up into groups of two, Jonesy and Amber, who was also a soldier, and Elena and Jake, and Mara and Nina. They're the kind of two. So Nina is like this kind of uptight character. It's like a kind of, I don't know, it seems like she's maybe like a kind of mental head or something, or like kind of goth,
goth-esque.
Yeah,
Hot Topic kid.
Yeah, very much so.
I will say that, like, when we first meet Nina, she's immediately like another unlikable character. The way she, like, Jake tries to help her out and she's kind of a dickhead to him, and you're kind of like, okay, so she's not particularly likable either. And then Jake, you know, he's like, oh, you smuggle this bar in, and, but he's going to give it to her, but then she's like being a bit of a bitch about stuff, and then Jake is like, well, fine, I'll eat your bar. And so you're kind of at this point, first time ever watching it, I remember being like, okay, out of everyone I've seen, the only person I really care about is Henry Rollins and maybe Mara. Like, I don't like any of these characters right now. They're all just seem like they're willing to step over each other to get to the top of this thing, which is, again, the very nature of these god-awful reality shows.
That's very true. And, you know, I mean, I was the exact same, you know, like you say, Nina is a pretty unlikable character, certainly in the beginning. And I mean, like, Henry Rollins is awesome from the beginning. Mara seems like an interesting character, and she is very well played. Do think that the actress who plays her, Alexa Palladino, who's probably best known for her role in Boardwalk Empire, she probably the puts in probably the second best performance in the movie. I would say, acting wise. And so, yeah, I mean, obviously stuff happens from there before we get to, you know, what I want to talk about with Mara. But again, there's not a massive amount. It's just a lot of kind of walking in the woods. There's a kind of establishing kind of character relationships and establishing that Michael or M is like really a complete asshole who just wants to make the trashiest reality TV show. And
like, what did he says? Sex is America's dirty little secret.
Yeah.
You can't talk about it in church, but everybody wants to watch it at home on TV. And he's trying to set Elena and Jake up for kind of like some on-camera skinny dipping or sex or something. And Jake, this is where the first moment where I'm kind of like, okay, maybe Jake's not a complete asshole, because Jake is kind of like, dude, this is ridiculous, and walks away. And I'm kind of like, okay, dude seems to have some degree of morals or ethics. Cool. That's a start. But yeah, M is just, he's just showing all his cards here for how much of a scumbag he really is.
Yeah, absolutely. He's just, he's not the worst, because Jonesy is the worst, but he is.
It's so true.
But he's pretty terrible.
I will never defend Jonesy. I will always say that I think that Jonesy serves a pivotal part of this movie to be the character that you hate more than the hillbillies. But at the same time, I'm not going to sit here and defend Jonesy. I would kill him.
Yeah.
I would burn him. But it's funny, because at this time in the 2000s, this was a big factor of reality TV. Everybody was tuning into Big Brother to see who was hooking up with who. And it was all fabricated. These people would come out and they would have no relations, because there was nothing. It was all done for the camera, for show. And so I do like that Joe kind of tried to kind of playfully, again, like it's not something out of tone for this movie. But he still manages to take a shot at that side of reality TV that's really fabricated and just done to get views.
Yeah, I know what you mean. In terms of that, you know what I mean? Like, yeah, it's kind of solid satire on, you know, the way reality TV is set up and the way, you know, it's very much reality in quotation marks. And a lot of it is kind of staged or semi-staged.
Yeah.
And like you say, yeah, this is kind of the first time you get a kind of character beat with Jake, where you're like, oh, you know, he might not just be the douchey jock that he is kind of initially presented as. I mean, I'm not sure. Yeah, he develops into a kind of more caring character, but at the same time, I'm not, you know, like, I think the character still ends up being slightly bland, a bit of a kind of milquetoast kind of character.
I don't want to play my cards too early, so I'm going to save some stuff for later, but
no problem. But you know, like, this is a fairly swift moving movie. It doesn't kind of hang around too long in terms of like hanging out with the characters. So like, Henry Rollins is attacked in the forest. Arrows are firing at him, and he tries to fight back, but then he gets captured by the mutants. And at that point, you're kind of like, oh no, don't tell me Henry Rollins is out of the movie.
Yeah. You're like, I might as well just turn this thing off. Rollins is out, I'm gone. Okay. Yeah, I mean, I even love the knife throw in that scene where he lobs a knife and just embeds it in I think it's Three Fingers.
I think it is Three Fingers, yeah.
He just embeds the knife in him, but then that's where you come to realize that these mutants are quite tough. The Three Fingers just takes it right back out. Doesn't even knock a star out of him. And yeah, incapacitates Henry Rollins. And like you say, that's the first moment where it's the first point in this movie where you actually care enough about somebody that you're saddened at the thought of them dying, as opposed to being like, kill that guy, kill that guy, kill that guy, please kill that guy. Jonesy.
Absolutely. Yeah, I mean, like, particularly with, you know, yeah, Jonesy is very much one of those characters in a slasher movie where you're like, oh, god damn it, why is he not dead yet? I can't take any more of his sex jokes.
It's literally like, if I knew that guy in reality, he would be so, I would distance from myself from him so much. Like, I would never speak to that guy in reality. Like, he would not be in my circle of friends. Or if somebody I knew was friends with him, I would, like, stop being friends with them. Just if they were like, no, Jonesy's a good dude, I'd be like, I'm sorry, our friendship is over.
this is the end for us.
But like, we also, so right after the Henry Rollins being put out of commission, we have Mara sets off a trap and she one of the challenges pops up that she has to go out onto like a log over a river and get like this card or this antidote for the radiation, the fake radiation. And it's her first kind of proving herself moment again as well, where we see her, you know, do the thing that she didn't think she could do. And she kind of gets this like, yes, I'm actually maybe good enough to actually be able to do this thing. And Nina is still very much kind of a cold, unlikable character here. Nina hasn't started to shed her skin yet, I don't think. Nina is still very
not really. No, at that point, she's still like, I'm in it to win it, kind of.
Yeah. I'm not here to make friends. Yeah, you know. I forgot to mention that during the Texas battle, when Jake, when he says to Jake, you know, to the scene with Elena, and Texas Battles walks away, and Matthew Gary Holmes says, "I want a ditty. I got a Boy Scout." I think that's such a brilliant line. It's so silly. it's so 2000s as well. It aged so terribly, but I love it.
Oh yeah, for sure. I did want to highlight this as well, because I think it's really good stuff. So, like you said, Jake is played by Texas Battle, the wonderfully named Texas
Incredible
Battle.
Incredible name.
Not his real name. His real name is Clifton Quincy Battle, but
I would change my name to Texas Battle as well.
Yeah, I know. I know. But like, I was looking up his IMDb. Mini biography, which was apparently written by Texas Battle's agent. And I loved this paragraph so much that I felt I really needed to read it out on the pod. So Texas Battle, you know, he's been in this movie. He was also in Final Destination 3 and various other things, but that's two of the things I've seen him in. But this paragraph is amazing. Well done to Texas Battle agent. Texas is a thespian, an athlete, and some might even say a Renaissance man, bringing a character and style that is both original and refreshing. If he's not diving into his next script, Texas can be found kicking it on the beach, shooting hoops, or working on his next rap.
That is exceptional.
I felt it needed to be read out. It's just, well.
Oh my God, that's actually incredible. Yeah, it's funny because I remember the first time I saw this, though, I was like, I know that guy. What the hell do I know that guy from? Like, it was really plaguing me. And then it wasn't until I looked him up after, I was like, oh, Final Destination 3. Check, yes. And apparently that's what Joe saw him in to cast him in this movie.
And that kind of makes sense, yeah. Because, I mean, like, all of the people had been in other horror movies.
Like, Nina.
The actress played Nina, plays Nina Erica Learson? Learson. She was in the Texas Chainsaw remake, and she was in Blair Witch 2, which is, I'm sure, ranks high in her CV.
It's, Blair Witch 2, Book of Shadows needs to be in your guilty pleasures list.
Yeah, no, that's fair. If I do a second season, I'll need to think up a kind of an episode where Blair Witch 2 can be in it. Because
when that happens, guys, I'll be back.
For sure. This season of it like runs to June, and obviously I've already got the episodes all lined up, but if I'm doing it again, which I probably will, Blair Witch 2 needs to be in there, because like you say, definitely not a good film, but definitely guilty pleasure. Ahoy.
As you say, Erica Learson was in that, and I have to say not that this is particularly difficult, but I think she's doing, by the end of this movie, I think she's doing much better work here than she did in Book of Shadows
or Texas Chainsaw, for to be fair, you know, like, I mean, I've not seen her in anything else. Like, of the three things, you know, I think this is the best work she's done.
Yes. Are we getting to M's shining moment of the movie?
You mean, right, yes. And then this is kind of where Nina first shows her kind of sheds a bit of her skin and becomes a little bit more likable. So yes, so yeah, it shows his true colors. Basically, after Jake walks away, Elena propositions him, sexually propositions him. He, of course, doesn't say, "Oh, I have a girlfriend," and that's really not on. He, of course, just accepts everything that is happening to him. And Mara sees this after completing her task to get the card to kind of save her in the game. And
that's
going to
be a hell of a come down. It's like, yay, I got this card. Oh, that's my boyfriend getting a blowjob. No.
Fuck.
Oh, no. And then just like 10 feet away from them, there's a redneck that's a hillbilly mutant that's enjoying this show as well.
Yeah.
But yeah, like you say, we get that moment where Mara is obviously very upset about seeing this. You know, and Nina kind of tries to talk her through it and explains, you know, like, well, she talks a little bit about, you know, stand up for yourself, do this, let's go down there and kick his ass. And you kind of, she's still got a bit of coldness to her, but you start to see like, okay, maybe she's not solely in it for herself. Maybe when she does see somebody that needs help, she is willing to be there for them.
But then Nina basically says, let's go beat him up. And Mara's like, yeah, that's not me. And she's like, come on, he deserves it. Fuck him up. And then like Mara's like, no, really, I really, really don't want to do that. I don't want to be like you. And then Nina immediately reverts to being a complete bitch again.
Yeah, she gets all huffy about that. To be fair, Mara does kind of like, the way she shouts that is very like...
Yeah, no, like, I can see why she'd be offended, to be fair. Yeah, I suppose.
Yeah. It gets a bit heated kind of out of nowhere. We see Nina starting to try and kind of look out for somebody, and then we see, but like in her way that maybe doesn't line up with the other person. So what we also learn about Nina is that she's obviously very stubborn and very bullheaded. And Mara kind of, we realize that Mara is maybe not quite as meek as we thought she was either, because she's very much in this situation able to stand up for herself and be like, no, I'm not doing that. But yeah, as you said, then Nina reverts to like, well, fine, screw you then. Like, I don't care. I'm in it to win it. Is this then where Jonesy and Amber find some delicious looking barbecue?
Yes, I believe at this point is where they find some delicious looking barbecue, and they're like, oh, we've not had it. Well, you know, we're trying to look for food. You know, like, fuck this like fishing malarkey. Like, yeah, we get like, just before that, we had like a very awkward scene with them where she finds an arrow and makes a kind of spear, and then Jonesy makes some terrible sex joke again. And
just continues to pester her on ending.
And then, of course, it's revealed that Amber is a lesbian, but that does not stop Jonesy's sex besting at all. Yeah, and then...
Because he is the spawn of Satan, obviously.
Yeah, he's fucking awful. We cannot say that enough. If you learn nothing from this episode, listener, you will learn two things. Henry Rollins is awesome, and Jonesy is very much the fucking worst. That is,
I just want to see Henry Rollins beat up Jonesy for an hour and a half. Just hit his head off a tree for an hour and a half. Perfect. it's true, though. Like, again, like, I feel like, it's a shame because I feel like Amber, the character of Amber, probably has a lot more potential. But being paired up with Jonesy puts her in the situation where all she gets to do is be like, stop making sex jokes, stop making sex jokes, stop making sex jokes. And yeah, I kind of feel for her because I do think, again, that there's layers to that character that we never get to actually unwrap.
That's true, because there is a scene later on where you get a kind of glimpse of her character and a glimpse of her kind of character motivations, but she seems underwritten because, like you say, she's paired with Jonesy. So like, yeah, her whole character becomes like, stop being a dickhead, stop being a dickhead, stop being a dickhead. And then, yeah, so then she kind of becomes like a kind of nothing character. And yeah, she could have been an interesting character, particularly given the glimpse of the or backstory that we do get kind of in
and
a
like,
little bit.
Even down to the fact that I know that Joe Lynch's inspiration for her as a character was Vasquez from Aliens, but mm-hmm. I don't think we ever get to see that on display in the movie because, as I say, I think if she had been paired with any other character, if she had been paired with Mara, you know, we might have gotten to see something. But I think because she's literally there to be the person that Jonesy keeps hounding and just has to basically keep spraying him with water like a horny dog. Like she doesn't get to do a hell of a lot beyond that. We do, as you say, we do get to see more of a little bit more of her later on and a little bit of kind of digging below the surface. But yeah, it's just a shame because I think that she had a chance to be a really strong character in this. Just if it wasn't for that god awful asshole.
Yeah.
As I say, I love this movie, but I will die in the head. Like Jonesy is awful. As I say, if anyone's friends with Jonesy, I'm not friends with you. but yeah, so yeah, and they've got the barbecue, and then we're back with Dale Murphy.
Yes. So good. That's what I was going to come on to. So then what happens is the biggest moment of relief in the movie, we cut to Dale Murphy hanging upside down. For some reason, the mutants nearly always kill people, but in this case, just captured Dale Murphy. And so he's been captured. He's just hanging there upside down, three fingers kind of taunting him.
Stabbing him repeatedly.
Yeah, stabbing him repeatedly. We're like, yeah, god damn it, thank god Henry Rollins is still very much alive.
Yep. And it's funny because as Three Fingers stabs him repeatedly, we're like, oh wow, Henry Rollins is basically seemingly as unkillable as these mutants. Awesome. but yeah, he fights back against Three Finger.
So there is a bit where you see Henry Rollins hanging upside down.
Yeah.
But then I don't think the Rollins fight back happens slightly later.
Later,
we cut back to Nina and Mara, and they discover Mara's like needs a phone, wants to who's she phoning again? Again, we just like for help of like to get them out of the forest or something, like the studio or something. But and they discover the kind of family home of the mutant family.
This is the moment where Mara goes for me from being like, okay, she's the one that I kind of like am following and I trust her and she seems whatever. When she's like just breaking into this random cabin in the middle of these woods and she's like, it's fine, come on in. And like Nina's like, this is not a good idea. This is really dumb. I'm like, actually, my money's on her surviving now because this is dumb. Like, Mara, what are you doing? This is really stupid of you. Because yeah, it's like, don't get me wrong, go to the door, knock. Hey, is there anybody there? No, there's no one here. Okay, cool. Nothing we can do about that. But like the fact that she just like randomly breaks into this person's house, I'm like, Mara, what happened to you? Seeing that happen with him has changed you.
It's kind of, she's lost her love and now she's broken. I know what you mean. And so Nina suddenly becomes the kind of sensible one, and yeah, you're kind of on her side of just being like, yeah, Mara, like I don't think that's advisable. Just breaking into somebody's house, and then of course it's not advisable because then they see a mutant birth sister gives birth to a new little mutant. Hillbilly thing.
So cute.
Yes. so lovely. But this moment is obviously disturbed. Obviously the mutant family realize that they are being watched by Mara and Nina and then attack them. And then again something of a weird scene. Like they have to barricade the bedroom door with the bed, and then they appear to escape through a kind of compostable toilet. But like an outhouse. But when they emerge from the house, running away from the house, they're completely clean.
It's funny because every time I see that part, it doesn't matter how many times I've seen this movie, which is a lot. I watched it twice over the weekend. I always expect them to come out of that toilet looking disgusting, covered in feces, and every time they come out of them, I was like, oh, that's so weird. Why are they clean? And again, I question, was it an edit issue? Was it, you know, something Sartre didn't pick up, sir? I don't know. But it's just, it is very peculiar. You would imagine that family is not the most, like, I doubt that the toilet is particularly clean.
Exactly.
So you would expect them to be absolutely destroyed coming out of it. I do agree.
It's a weird moment in the movie. They just come running away and you're just like, they look exactly the same. Like, you'd expect them to be covered head to toe in shit. Like, it literally doesn't make any sense.
And like, it's a shame because it is such a great way. Like, it is, when I see that scene, I always go, oh, that's such a great idea for an escape. Like, you never see that in these things, is like, oh, you're screwed, you're barricaded in, how are you going to get out? Well, the only way out is through the shitter. Oh my God, that's horrific. But then, yeah, when they come out the other side, you're like, all the believability of that moment, I totally agree. It's like, oh, but they're totally clean. They should be covered head to toe in shite. Like, it's not. And yeah, I do think, I again don't know the full story behind. I do know from Joe talking about it that it was low budget, that it was a quick turnaround. But like, I don't know the specifics of like, maybe there was stuff that got changed in the edit but yeah, I do agree. It's very jarring when you see them totally almost looking cleaner than they were when they went into the house.
Yeah, I mean, they look fucking immaculate. Like, it's just very, very strange. It's like there's barely a hair out of place on either of them.
And then, I mean, it does. I mean, it might have helped if Mara had been covered in shit. She might have been a bit of camouflage so that she doesn't take an axe to the head. But unfortunately, because she doesn't get herself covered in shite, Mara, who is our final girl at this point, as she's running through the woods with Nina, takes an axe to the head.
Yeah, in an entertaining kill. So like, yeah, it's like a kind of small throwing axe, and it just comes at her at the side of her head, and like it's like shot well, you know, like it's because it just kind of comes out of nowhere, and then suddenly she is just bleeding out the side of the head and just collapses to the ground. So yeah, so I think this was a great idea, but also like, because there had been like genuine effort to make her like a developed character in a way that most of the other characters are not. And I would argue even later on, it's just, I think it's a kind of great strength, you know, in terms of like that subversion of like, you've set this thing up where everybody in the audience thinks this is our final girl. Everything points to, she's kind of, you know, got that kind of meekness of a final girl, but that kind of hint of toughness. And she's given that pep talk by Henry Rollins. So you're like, oh, okay. So it's set up nicely. But then, yeah, I do think that it's probably the second best acting performance in the movie. Mm. And it's probably the most well-rounded character outside of, you know, our favorite, our obvious, obvious favorite.
Mm.
So kind of taking her away, I think it hurts as much as it helps. You know, I think it kind of evens out, I suppose.
I think for me, I think it's a, like you said, I think it's a great subversion of the final girl trope. But I think that we have to flounder for a bit, and I'm okay with that, with not knowing who we're supposed to follow now. Like, I'm okay with the idea of kind of still not being 100% on Nina or Jay, and just kind of being like, oh wait, that was at this point, outside of Henry Rollins, the only other character I liked, and now she's gone. So I guess it's just going to be a kill fest. I don't really care about any of the rest of these people. But that's where I think the strength for me comes in, is, and we'll get to this in a bit, but like, I think we have very different opinions on certain stuff here, because I think that some of the characters, I think they develop really well, but not at this moment. Like, in this, you're right, after we get that scene with Mara, we have our Lord of the Rings homage shot where, you know, Nina's down behind a tree branch and it's your Nazgul shot. The Nazgul is Pa standing over her, I think.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And at that point, I'm still not on board with Nina. I'm kind of like, I don't really care if she gets grabbed and killed here. It doesn't really bother me. For me, without getting too ahead of myself, I would find that the Nina from like the third act, I do get more invested in, and I'm like, oh, I kind of don't want this person to die now because they have a couple of layers, which I do have a whole bit on it, so we'll save that.
Okay, no problem. I do think, yeah, no, I, yeah, after this point, I probably concur that like Nina becomes the kind of most developed character after. But anyway, kind of cutting back to the plot. So yeah, so we kind of cut back to the scene that Michael was at, and we get a bit more interaction with him. And Elena, he goes away. Elena is left kind of on herself. She says she's going to do some sunbathing. We cut to brother, one of the mutants, furiously masturbating.
I've written fapping redneck, so yeah.
So that's what's happening. And then much to
that's
the...
such a Joe Lynch thing, man. It's such a Joe Lynch thing. It's like I can just see Joe being like, well, we gotta have a shot of the mutant masturbating. Come on. Like, are you serious?
Oh dear. Yeah, so yeah. So that so it's certainly, you know, it's not what you expect to see right enough. But anyway, that is what happens, much to the annoyance of sister, who is obviously having an incestuous relationship with brother. She like kind of hits him about a bit and then is furious with Elena. So then Elena has to go. And this is probably my least favorite kill of the movie. Like, sister kind of manically slashes at Elena's back. It's kind of done in kind of jarring, shaky cam. And, you know, like, it just...
Mm.
Yeah, this kill didn't really do much for me at all.
I think this is... I don't even know if there is a non-unrated cut, because I think Joe has said that he was just allowed to shoot it as unrated. But it kind of feels like stuff that they would have left on the cutting room floor if it had to be.
Mm-hmm.
Like, for the NPA, if the NPA were like, no, you can't show the hacked up spine and protruding out of the back, they would have gladly left it out, because it maybe would have worked better without showing the back and stuff. I mean, I like the intensity of the moment. I like that that sister runs out and kind of just wails on her and then gets really hot for brother after killing her. It's like, oh cool, that's what gets these, you know, mutant hillbillies turned on. But I agree with you, it's by far and away not the film's strongest kill. I do think there's some cool special effects on the actual exposed spine, but again, that's a technical thing as opposed to a narrative thing. My next note, it's not my next note. Well
my next note is Rollins fight back. I think as
my next note is, let's keep Rollins. Come on.
That's good. So you may have noticed, listener, Henry Rollins very much escapes.
Oh, man, I love this scene. I think this could be one of my, like, alongside that opening kill, this could be one of my favorite sequences in the movie.
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's a great sequence. And then we will learn, I mean, these mutants are very durable, and we will learn right at the very end of the movie just how fucking durable.
Yep. Because, like, Henry Rollins manages to escape from his bindings, mess up three fingers in a, you know, one-on-one fight. Three fingers goes for his shotgun, which has got to be hard to pull the trigger with that hand, but no, it's his other hand, I think, is the trigger hand. And then Henry Rollins gets it off him and blasts him into the lake. And yeah, it looks pretty grisly. You wouldn't think anybody could survive that.
So yeah, so kill number 5, ?
Yeah, like, I think the whole sequence, as they say, with Henry Rollins' escape is just like the blocking, the actual intensity of it. If this film had just been 90 minutes of that, of just Henry Rollins kicking the shit out of Hillbilly Mutants, I would have just as easily still loved this movie immensely. But we're kind of heading back now to the RV and Matthew Curry Holmes. And I actually really like what they do here with the camera. So we'll say Pa has taken Mara's camera.
Yeah.
And we get this great, in my opinion, like, even though it's not a very suspenseful movie, a great suspense shot where Matthew Curry Holmes is looking at the monitor and he's like, it's not working. So he goes under the desk. And when he does, we see on the camera, on the monitor, that the camera is moving towards the RV and coming in right behind him. And I just think that's a really nice touch.
Yeah,
in a movie that's not known for suspense.
No, not at all. But yeah, no, what you say, I would agree with that. That's a pretty decent kind of suspense moment. You know, you kind of seen similar things done before, but like, yeah, it's a cool moment. And yeah, and then Matthew Curry Holmes gets kidnapped yes. by
some two joyriding mutants.
By the joyriding mutants, and he also gets an arrow through the shoulder, and is driven away in the stolen RV. I was going to say never to be seen again, but he is seen again. But that is later. That is later on.
And we would, if he wasn't a total asshole at this point, we'd be like, "Oh no, he's been kidnapped." But we're like,
"Yeah, nah. Who cares?"
Yeah, you're like, "Oh well." Serves you right.
After Jonesy, he's the character everybody wants to die the most. So like, it's like, whatever, man. Yeah, sure.
Go ahead.
Oh yeah. So this is when we get a bit of character stuff, because this is when like we have, so Amber and Jonesy are eating the barbecue, and are joined by Jake. He joins them for some tasty barbecue.
Him on the cob.
So yeah, so at this point we do get a bit of extra character development here, not from Jonesy is just Jonesy and that's it.
They literally call him out on that, because they're like, what would you do with the money? And he's like, I'd throw a massive party. And they're like, you are literally a walking cliche, like you are a stereotype.
You are yeah. You're just the absolute dictionary definition of like dude bro asshole, like that's it. But yeah, so like Jake is not just the kind of blockheaded jock that he was presented at his first. He wants to become a sports scientist because he got injured and that robbed him of his potential career in the NFL, and he wants to stop, you know, help other people, to something happening to other people. And then Amber wants to be free of debt from her father, who disapproves of the fact that she is a lesbian. So, you know, and it's kind of a nice scene. It gives them a bit extra depth that they previously didn't have. It kind of works. And then that scene of a bit extra character development is interrupted by a terrified Nina, who explains the whole mutant hillbilly cannibal situation. And of course, the one person who doesn't believe it and believes it's all Hollywood special effects is Jonesy. Of course, Jonesy is going to be the non-believer.
And Jonesy is the type of guy who would tell you not to wear a mask. Like,
oh yeah, for sure.
I know here that Jonesy says, like, he actually uses the word shit ghost when he's farting. And oh, yeah. Like, I literally, the note I wrote after that moment was, Jonesy deserves to die. that's where I was landing at this moment. I was like always from the second he's on screen, but like, it had to be written down here. I had to just remind myself in written form, this person deserves to die. Not even needs to or blah, blah, blah. He deserves to. But I did also note on my notes that, like, I do think, yeah, like, I think that Texas Battles thing there, when he's talking about his thing, it does kind of give you this, like, oh, okay. Like you said, he's not as one-dimensional anymore. And like that, Amber, it's just a shame that they couldn't have had. The only thing I'll say here is it's a shame they couldn't have had this scene maybe a bit earlier with all the characters and maybe get to see that maybe they're not all total dickheads. But then again, as I say, in a movie like this, I think you need some dickheads, because I think you need the people that you enjoy. Like, this movie is as much about the kills as it is about the characters. So like,
oh yeah, for sure,
want to see eat it in grisly ways. Jonesy being number one. Yeah, as you say, Jonesy is the one that's like, oh, it's a Hollywood special effect makeup. Let me explain it to you. Let me mansplain it to you. When Nina points, or Nina or Jake, that points out a very recognizable tattoo on their barbecue.
Indeed. So, like, yes, earlier in the douchey intro videos, we had seen that Kimberly had a snake tattoo that was done in the kind of infinity symbol. And that symbol is imprinted on their barbecue, proving that it was Kimberly they've been eating all along.
And I mean, from the reactions, it seems like human flesh is really tasty, because they were digging that barbecue before they found out.
Oh yeah, for sure. They were just like, apparently it just tasted like pork. That seemed to be what they were saying. Human flesh just tastes like pork.
Scott, when they're running through the forest here after it's like, okay, this is really happening, and they run away, Nina steps on a nail in a piece of wood. And that is one of my big triggers. Like, it's not that I think it's the most horrific thing ever or anything, but it's just one of those things, like somebody stubbing their toe or stepping on a piece of Lego. I've stood on a nail. So when I see somebody stand on a nail, I literally get that moment of feeling the pain again. Yeah. It's like PTSD. I feel it again. And that it doesn't matter where I see those shots. Like, I think A Quiet Place with the nail on the steps was another, you know, but like, I just watching this again and that moment, I was like, I shrank up, because I think it's one of those pains that's so relatable.
Yeah, no, I can definitely see that for sure. Yeah, it's, it's something about that, you know, like, I can think of a few kind of gross kind of feet things in horror movies.
Like tendons when people slice the
bone. Yeah. There's a particularly horrific shot in the movie Revenge. That is, man,
brutal.
But it, like, really is. I don't know what it, I mean, like, they must have in France some of the best practical effects people, because like, based martyrs. On the evidence of like Martyrs and Inside and Revenge, all those movies,
Split Romance,
fucking hell, yeah,
but like, just
some of the nastiest stuff anyway.
Oh, definitely. But one thing I'll say here is that, like, with the characters, like at that campfire scene before Nina appears, or even when Nina goes down and Jake has to go down and help her, and he takes off her, he's like, take off your wrist, wrist bangles.
Kind of, she's got kind of sweatbands on.
Sweatbands. There's the word I was looking for. And she's like, no, I don't want it. And he's like, I know what it is. Take it off. And we see that she has, you know, marks from where she's tried to commit suicide, or that she caught herself. And I feel like in this moment, there's a lot more going on here about these characters in the last like 20 minutes compared to the entire rest of the movie, because you're starting to see that, like, you know, these characters have issues, like Amber, her issue relates to her sexuality. You know, Texas Battles is kind of like a hero complex of like wanting to help people or wanting to save people. You know, and then Nina suffers with depression, which, being somebody that suffers with depression, it makes her, and seeing how she is, I suddenly start to go, oh, I've kind of been a dickhead like that as well. Like, I've kind of been, there's times where I've been standoffish with people, or, you know, because it is almost a protective defense mechanism.
So
suddenly I started to kind of go, okay, compared to the type of characters that you get in like Friday the 13th or, you know, a lot of other slasher movies, these characters do actually, while it might only be one thing that makes them unique, it's more than a lot of other slasher movies give characters.
No, that's a fair point. And I definitely think, in some ways it's kind of, too little too late. But in other ways, I do think, like you say, it's a lot more than a lot of other slashers give their characters. And I don't know, like, certainly the character of Nina, like, really grows on you throughout the movie. And I think by the end of the movie, you're really rooting for her. There's something, Jake is like, he's an all right character. And like, you do get these kind of extra layers to him, like later on, you know, first in that the barbecue scene and stuff. I don't know. I don't know if it's maybe just, and no offense to Mr. Battle, because, like, you know, fantastic name, but there's something about him that's a little on the bland side. And I think, you know, his act, I mean, he did star in The Bold and the Beautiful, and his acting style is a little on the kind of daytime soap opera. And I don't want to be too down on him, you know, like, I'm sure I can't act out a paper bag, so, like, you know, like, no, people in glass houses, but...
I mean, even taking it, though, I mean, this is definitely jumping a little bit ahead. No, actually, I'm still going to keep that one in the back pocket.
Okay.
Later. But we're kind of, as you say, this movie does move at 90 miles an hour, and so, like, you know, from that scene where he helps Nina and, you know, with her, or he kind of bandages up her foot with the sweatband. We're back to Henry Rollins, who's found Oldtimer.
He has found Oldtimer, who at first seems like he might be. I mean, I think as a viewer, you kind of always suspect that he's probably in on it, but, like, he kind of semi-convinces Henry Rollins that he's just like an old guy, and then we kind of get some shoehorned in backstory to the origins of the mutant family. And then, of course, it is revealed that Oldtimer is the grandfather of the mutant family, and then he attacks Henry Rollins. They have a bit of a scuffle, in which time Henry Rollins...
Yeah, the dynamite.
Yes, in which time Henry Rollins manages to stuff a bit of dynamite down his back, and Oldtimer, I've literally just put kill number 5, Oldtimer goes kaboom. And having seen the behind the scenes, a little bit of the behind the scenes, I was entertained by this kill in the movie, but I'm even more entertained by it having seen the behind the scenes, just seeing the sheer boyish glee on the face of Joel Lynch as he watched the monitors for this kill. As it's really good stuff, top drawer stuff.
Also, I have to say that I actually think that the guy who plays Oldtimer, I think he does really good work here as well. Like, as in, I do, as you say, there is no denying that this dude, like, straight away you're like, okay, this guy is definitely shady and is more than likely one of these redneck mutants, just without the mutant part. But I think I actually like how the exposition is delivered, because it, as you said, it's shoehorned in, but I felt like his delivery is so natural, his performance is so natural, that it in the moment to me doesn't feel that. In the moment, it just feels like he's just telling a story, he's recounting a tale kind of thing. And I get that, yeah, once you take it outside of that and start going under a movie lens, it is like, yeah, that kind of rammed in exposition. But, like, I just think in the moment, it's really natural.
Yeah. Okay. And to be fair, the actor who plays Oldtimer, Wayne Robson, does a good job. And, you know, like, yeah, you kind of are drawn in to his storytelling as he gives you this kind of exposition dump of, like, how the family came to be in these.
And yeah, and plus, as he goes on, you start to realize, you're like, wait a minute, the only way he would know all of this stuff is if he was part of the, oh yeah, there we go.
yeah. I mean, like, yeah, like you say, you're suspicious from the get-go, but then you're like, wait, how would he... why would the family not have killed him if, like, he's definitely part of the family. He just doesn't look like them. So yeah, he blows up, and I think at this point, this is when we get Rollins as Rambo. That's, he tools up, he gets his dynamite and his bow and arrow, and yeah, he does the old kind of Rambo stroke Predator makeup, and it's good stuff.
It's just, it's so fantastic, like, it really is. And I mean, what better way? Like, we go from that to hillbilly mutant monsters, boning in the woods. I mean,
oh yeah, yeah, that's right. So the gang, the surviving gang, Jonesy still Scooby alive. Gang. Fucking Scooby, hell.
Jonesy is Fred, definitely.
Yeah. So yeah, Jonesy, Amber, Jonesy, Amber, Nina, and Jake all stumble across brother and sister fucking. The first think that brother is raping Elena because sister is wearing Elena's face, but then she takes off Elena's face and surprise, it's sister. And then they're coming to hunt you down. The weird thing about this scene that happens in here is like, so they seem to have built up a little bit of trust. You know, chatting after the barbecue and all that, and then at the very first instant, when Nina like basically falls down a hole like a trap, Amber just assumes that she has left them to die. Like she just assumed, like she just snaps back to being like, "Nah, she's a bitch. She must have just left us." And I was like, "What?" It was like, yeah, there's kind of this...
The only thing there is that Nina wasn't there during that kind of bonding moment at the fire. So I think that maybe to Amber's mind, she knows nothing really more about Nina and just presumes she is still exactly what she first saw her as.
I suppose that's true. I suppose that's true.
Because it's Jake, isn't it, that goes back to the hole. And again, this is a moment that I like Jake, because we know he has an arm injury, and yet he pulls her out with, I believe, his bad arm, because yes, it's obviously, I don't know, whatever reason, the only arm he can reach in with. And, you know, he does that selflessly again, like kind of reaches in and helps Nina out. And so at this point in my mind, I'm kind of going... As I say, my mind is now transitioned to like, okay, I like Nina and Jake and would like to see them live. Like if there's anyone that I want, them and Henry Rollins, if they make it out of the movie, I'm happy. Whereas, I mean, Amber, I don't think she was given enough to have anything at that point for me to, as I say, there's still more than there is for a lot of other slasher characters, or, you know, survivor characters, but it's still not quite enough to give her that like, oh, I'm really rooting for this character. Whereas, and I know you don't necessarily feel the same about Jake, but like I, as a pair, especially, I'm kind of like, okay, I would like Nina and Jake to make it out. And something that I do like as well is it would have been so easy here for Joe Lynch to shoehorn in some kind of like doughy-eyed, you know, Nina looking at Jake like, you're my hero. You say,
all right, yeah, some sort
or
of
some
romance
bollocks thing, yeah, like that, which always happens in these kind of movies, like people fall in love instantaneously and stuff. But what I like is that they just treat each other as, for the whole movie, they just treat each other as kind of in like mutual, like there's a mutual understanding of we're just human beings. Like it's, there's none of this bullshit of like, well, you're a guy and I'm a girl, so we gotta, you know, it's like, no, like these are just two people trying to survive a situation. There's none of that bollocks, which I do like.
Yeah. Okay. No, that's fair. That's fair. And then we're pretty much up to the point that, yeah, so this kind of irritates me. So, like, yes, Jake saves Nina from the hole, and then we cut to Jonesy and Amber, who are running away. Jonesy gets caught in a trap where he's slung up in
and
the
Amber
air.
Amber should have just ran the fuck away at that point.
Yeah, and like, yeah, I mean, like, Amber has been harassed by this guy throughout the whole movie, and yet just needlessly sacrifice herself, and then she gets trapped, and then she's flung up in the air, and then the movie kind of cops out and tries to semi redeem Jonesy at the last minute. And at this point, I'm like, no, fuck you.
No,
movie.
No redemption.
Fuck
I
you.
Agree. It's like Jonesy is doing that thing that all dude bros do when they're out of their depth and of like being like, oh, I'm not really a bad guy, I swear, you know, but I'm just so scared. And you're like, no, you are still the same horrible, annoying, disgusting dude bro that you were 50 minutes ago. Just now you're scared and will say anything to try and get yourself out of the situation. And he even does try to do the heroic, like, no, you go on without me. To which I think the best output up there would have been Ember just being like, okay, thanks, Jones, and cheers. Like, wow, that's really big of you, and run on.
Yeah, for sure. For sure.
Now, in saying all of that, I think we get a really nice, I consider it a very tender moment where Pa and brother arrive to see the two of them strung up.
Yeah,
Pa is about to take the killing shot with his bow and arrow, and he looks down at his son. And is like, nah, you know what? You take the killing shot. And it's, for a bunch of crazy cannibal, mountain dwelling mutants, it's tender. It's got Ken Kersinger adds quite a bit of tenderness to his paw in this moment.
He does indeed. He does indeed.
Most famously known as playing Jason in
Freddy versus Jason,
which Kane Hodder will never forgive him for.
Yeah. No, Kane Hodder is very, very upset about that. Not that Ken Kersinger had anything really to do with it.
Exactly.
He's going to be mad at anybody. Me mad at Jeff Katz,
or Derek Mears. Yeah. But I do like that moment because again, it does show you that this crazy mutant hillbilly family are a family, as bizarre as they are. And then also we get another, in my opinion, another really cool kill out of it. It's a nice homage as well to, I believe there's a kill exactly like this in one of the Friday the 13th with the two, like a 2-for-1 arrow shot.
So yeah, at first you don't realize it's a 2-for-1. You just see the arrow go into Jonesy's eye and then it pans out and you realize that the arrow has gone through Amber's head and into Jonesy's eye.
And then brother runs underneath and starts lapping up the blood. And it's funny because again, at this point, I'm going to be blunt. I don't particularly care about Jonesy or Amber that much. I'm like, of all the characters, you still haven't given me enough to really care.
No.
So if I get a good kill out of this moment, I'm happy. And I did. So I'm happy. That's basically where I am.
Yeah.
Here.
I mean, it was a good kill. No, the only thing that annoyed me was it kind of, I feel like it kind of cops out with Jonesy and in that kind of the trying to create a kind of tender moment between him and Amber right at the very end. And
I agree.
Yeah, I just wasn't on board with that. I was like, no movie. No, I'm not having this at all.
That's beyond fair. Jonesy is an irredeemable 100%. They arrive at the sawmill and they find all the Jake and Nina arrive at the sawmill that they've been heading to and they find all those beautiful barrels that say may cause birth defects, you think?
that's pretty good. Amber and Jonesy were supposed to meet Jake and Nina at this paper mill. And they're obviously not there as they've been killed, as we discussed. And then we get a kind of pretty cool scene where Jake and Nina discover just shitloads of abandoned cars.
Good scrap business if they weren't crazy cannibals killing everybody. There's enough cars that they would have a decent scrap business.
For sure. it's pretty cool because then it kind of notifies the viewer that this has been going on for a long time. A lot of fucking people have died.
Yeah, and when they get into the mill, I just need to talk about this for a sec. There's a moment where they come across a video and they see M being tortured and killed on camera, and all I could think watching that scene now versus when I first saw this about 4 or 5 years ago was, I know Resident Evil 7 was massively influenced by Texas Chainsaw Massacre and Texas Chainsaw 2, but that moment where M dies on camera is so like some of the scenes in Resident Evil 7. And obviously Resident Evil 7 is very much hillbilly horror, I really got a feel this time around that they probably took a lot of influence from this movie for Resident Evil 7 as well, which gave me a whole different appreciation of it. It's something I really want to look into because I reckon they did, because there are these kills that you see on videotapes in Resident Evil 7 and it's just so like that Matthew Curry Holmes kill in this.
Yeah, for sure. Although I do want to point this out, as I do want to talk about this as well, in terms of like M's death, and you see him on camera being decapitated. And I mean, my note after that is, why did Jake watch so long? Like, he just seems like he just seems to revert to being an idiot jock. Like, he's just like glued to it. And it's like, you know, it's just, yeah. Yeah. And I was just like, wouldn't you just, you'd be like, oh, fuck, he's going to get killed. I can hear him screaming. I'm going to run away. You know, no, I'm going to get captured because I'm an idiot.
And yeah, if he had any sense, he would have run away. Instead, he ends up in a fight with Pa and gets his ass whooped. It turns out that being the jock doesn't help him here. Pa has got a lot of strength on him and, takes him to school. And so then at this point, everyone's pretty much captured. And it's Henry Rollins as Rambo to save the day. You know,
yeah. So at this point, everybody gets captured. Jake is strung up, Nina's in a cage, and then we get this kind of very Texas Chainsaw Massacre,
yes,
dinner party, where like the kind of cannibal slop is served by Ma. And is like Nina's forced to eat it, and she's tied up in a chair with barbed wire.
It's funny because I just think it's funny that she's vegan and they're forcing her to eat people.
Actually, another note that I made that I found genuinely funny as well was like I've just written here, even mutants say grace apparently.
Yes, I have a note on that as well. I said, well, you know they're a nice family because they say grace. And I know that Joe has said in the past that everybody thinks that this is a homage to the dinner scene from Texas Chainsaw, mm-hmm, but it's actually his homage to the dinner scene from Texas Chainsaw 2.
He
wears his influences on his sleeves very much, Joe does, as a filmmaker, and like there's nothing shy about this having echoes of Texas Chainsaw. And I think to its credit, I think it does the dinner scene as well as, you know, Texas Chainsaw 2 does. And especially, I just think that the fact that she's vegan and they're feeding her people is just another element of it that I just think is a bit playful, and even though it's kind of mean-spirited, it's kind of playful. I have to say, my next note is, right, Henry Rollins' irritation at blood falling down at him is actually quite hilarious. Like, he's not disgusted or horrified. He's just annoyed. Like, yeah, there's blood dripping down his face. And he's not like, oh, God, oh, this is disgusting. Oh, my God. He's just like, for fuck's sake, it's getting my eyes. Like, not bad annoyed, like. That's how badass Henry Rollins is.
Yeah, that's for sure. Yeah, because at this point, we cut to Henry Rollins coming to try and save the day. He blows up both brother and sister. So that's another two mutants down.
I think that is one of my other favorite sequences in the film, though. The way he leads them around with his blood, and then where he's hiding behind the thing, shoots brother. And the oorah at the end just fucking makes it. I just love it so much. Oorah! As he walks away. I'm just like, I swear, if they ever did a Rambo reboot, like, get Henry Rollins on the phone, man. He'd make an awesome Rambo.
Yeah, absolutely. And then, so after like blowing up brother and sister, Henry Rollins storms the kind of dining room, I suppose, comes to save Jake and Nina and lets them escape. And then he is attacked by Ma and Pa, and yeah, and then he has a kind of epic last stand where he gets like a couple of arrows fired into him, and then is eventually taken out with a kind of chain with the kind of ball bearings, but like wraps around his neck.
There's a name for that thing. I can't remember what it is.
I don't know.
But I will say, right, just one quick note on when he rescues them, that I'm sorry to keep going on with my one quick notes, but
no,
I really like that when Jake is trying to get Nina to pull her hands free and she can't, it's like a nice moment of realizing that like she's grown beyond her suicidal then or like it's kind of a reminder, like she had cut her wrist previously because she chose to, and in this situation she couldn't even though she needed to. I just thought that was a really nice little kind of very
I noticed that moment as well, you know, and like you say, yeah, it ties into that previous scene where she's revealed to have attempted suicide, and that was a good character. And by this stage, you know, I'm very much rooting for Nina at this stage, you know.
But also before we just jump on with the rest of the thing, I have a note that says I would have watched an entire franchise with Dale Murphy as the lead. Like, I if Wrong Turn 3, 4, 5, and 6 had all had Dale Murphy as the lead, I would have probably watched them, like 100%.
Oh, for sure. If Colonel Dale Murphy was just the rest of the series was just his revenge of him hunting down these mutant hillbilly cannibals, I would absolutely be on board with that.
I think that's why I genuinely get really upset at his death, because I'm like, no, there's so much potential in that character for like a whole series. Like, I would have watched him do anything, but he never died. So yeah, we can move on.
For sure. So yes, unfortunately he does die. And then we have the kind of final battle where it pretty much looks like Jake is going to die.
He's going to be mincemeat.
He's going to be made into mincemeat in this kind of I don't know what you call that, like kind of threshing machine, that kind of but then it ends up that he is not killed, and it turns the tables, and
with a little help from Nina, who breaks her all of her vegan habits and takes a good chunk out of Pa's neck.
That is true. Just jumps on his back, just rips into him, and then they fall into the big threat. Oh, I don't know what you call them.
I just call it a grinder.
Let's call it a grinder, like the big grinder thing. And then they're just turned to bloody mush. They just together forever as just big bloody lumps in a toxic barrel.
We all want to go with our loved ones.
And then, yeah, that's pretty much it. We've pretty much reached the end. Jake and Nina survive.
They drive away in the first the last vehicle that we see in the movie is the first vehicle that we saw in the movie, which I thought was cool as well.
The red Mustang that Kimberly was driving at the start of the movie. Jake and Nina jump into that, and they literally ride off into the sunset. But it's not the actual end of the movie, because then we cut to a shot of chemical waste running through the river, and then we see somebody filling up one of those baby bottles with the kind of toxic wastewater. And wouldn't you know it, despite being shotgunned halfway through the movie, Three Finger has somehow survived and is taking care of the mutant baby that we saw giving birth.
He gives him a little finger to suck on, which is brilliant. I just love that. I just think that's that's a very Texas Chainsaw-y kind of, you know, tongue-in-cheek bit of humor.
Yeah. Yeah, for sure. And then that is very much the end of the movie. So yes, Three Finger survives, and you know, he's basically the main villain. I think he's in the rest of the movies. I'm not 100% sure. I've not seen all six, but that might change. But more on that maybe another day.
I mean, so to kind of finally get to what I was going to say earlier on, I mean, just one of the things that I really like about the surviving characters in this movie, as much as there are things that aren't particularly fantastic about them, is that it does go so against type. Like, you have in a kind of a genre that's known for killing off black characters, you have the black guy and the goth chick. Who, you know, again, usually in these, like, Friday the 13th, you see the goth chick, and she's going to be the first one to die because she's probably going to be making out with someone or whatever. And, like, I just like one of the things that I do really like about this is that they take some of the characters and really turn them against type. I think that to its strength, by not doing that with everyone, like by Jonesy just being an annoying, horrible dude, bro, or Matthew Curry Holmes, you know, being a dickhead, like by not trying to make everybody have a saving grace. I know, as you say, the scene in the tree with Jonesy does kind of annoy me, that it does kind of try to be like, oh, he's not, maybe not as bad as we thought. But like, in general, it doesn't try to change your opinions on everyone. But when it does change your opinions of characters, in my opinion, that's my read on it anyway, I just like that it's like, it takes some of those just really hardened tropes of the 80s and kind of goes, well, you know what? In this movie, the black guy and the goth chick make it out, you know.
Yeah, no, I mean, I think that's for sure in its favor. I mean, like, on the downside, I do think, like, for example, Amber ends up being the most frustrating character in that she is given something of a grace note, but it's like the fact that she is given a grace note actually makes her almost a more unsatisfying character than if she was just like,
just
like, I am stereotypical badass Latina woman, you know, like,
You're totally right. I mean, I will say, I would always say that I think Amber is the biggest missed opportunity in the movie, because I think that, you know, she had, either if you are going to give her that backstory, then do more with her, then have her just be the person that Joey or Jonesy annoys, or as you say, don't do anything with her, just have her be Michelle Rodriguez in everything. Mm-hmm. Like, I do agree that I think that the biggest missed up, I think, characterization wise, two of the biggest issues I would have would be that, yeah, that moment where they try to redeem Jonesy, and the idea that, and like not necessarily seeming to know what to do with Amber. Like, you know, is she a character that we could root for, or is she just a disposable, and it never really gets resolved, so you don't really care either way. Which is a shame. Those would be definitely two of my biggest considerations character wise. But as I say, I just think that it does so much other good work with, just especially that idea at this time, even, I mean, God, it had been prevailing since the 80s, but there was just this overwhelming idea that, you know, people of color just didn't make it out of horror movies. You know, yes. It was always like, it was almost like a running joke, it felt like, in the early 2000s. You know, they'd come on and people would be like, oh, how long is that character going to make it? And you're like, I just like that this movie kind of said, you know what? Well, screw you. I'm going to make the jock, who yet again is also, the jock character was always very much a big white dude. I'm going to make the jock a black guy, and he's going to make it out. He's going to be one of the survivors. And he's going to have an element where he's not just a big dumb jock. He actually does care about more than, he's not just like, oh, dude, I want to hook up with the cheerleader, you know?
Yeah, for sure.
So like, look, I'm not going to sit here and say it does everything right. I definitely... And I think it would be even unfair to the movie to do that, because it is a big, dumb, fun movie. But I think that it does, at least within the constraints of being a dumb, fun movie, tries within what it has to make a couple of points about the horror tropes.
Yeah, for sure. I think, yeah, it does some decent subversion on some slasher tropes, and it does some decent subversions on reality show tropes as well. So
yes, true.
Yeah, you know, kudos to it. As I said at the top of the show, it has failed my definition of a guilty pleasure movie, but it was still great talking about it, and talking to you about it in particular, your enthusiasm for Wrong Turn 2. I mean, if people listening to this are not now feeling enthusiastic about Wrong Turn 2, having listened to you speak about it, like, then I do not know what those people have been listening to. But that's pretty much all for this episode of I don't even want to call it the guilty podcast. Pleasure now. this special all pleasure edition of the guilty pleasure series. Don't worry, next time people, it's definitely going to be guilty pleasures, because next time it's going to be either Ginger Dead Man or Santa's Sleigh in our Christmas edition of the guilty pleasure series, and there is no doubt about the lack of quality in those movies. Absolutely no doubt whatsoever.
I've seen Santa Sleigh. I haven't seen Ginger Dead Man. Now I know what to watch for Christmas. Cool. And Joe, I just want to say, Joe Lynch, because I know you're probably one of the only people that's listened to this whole episode because you wanted to hear me rave about your movie. Joe, I love your movie. I love you. You're a fantastic dude. And I will always champion this movie because I just think it is a hell of a lot of fun. And yeah, thank you for everything, sir.
Well, what a beautiful way to end the episode. So that just leaves me to thank my co-host, Paddy, for coming on and giving us all that great content and all that great love for Wrong Turn 2.
And oh, no, thank you, Scott.
That's just great. And thank you, listener, for checking out this latest episode of the series. And yeah, be sure to join us on the next one. Be sure to join us on the next episode, the next interview episode of the show, which will be out on Monday, where I'll be talking to Nicholas Payne Santos about his film It Cuts Deep. And yeah, if you leave us a review that's got the hashtag horror not fear, you will be automatically entered into a competition where you can win all of the movies covered in the Guilty Pleasure series, including this film. And that's from the ones we've done from June this year to June next year. So it'll be a total of 13 movies. So give us a review, put hashtag or not fear, our favorite one, that you can win all of those on DVD. And yes, that's all for this time. So until next time, see ya.
Bye.